Shrink Wrap Radio number 775. Psychiatrist David Burns, MD, on a new treatment for depression and anxiety.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest is renowned psychiatrist David Burns, MD. He was my guest around 12 years ago, speaking about healing troubled relationships. He's an award-winning researcher and author of the phenomenally successful Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, which sold 5 million copies worldwide. Today we'll be discussing his latest book, Feeling Great, The Revolutionary New Treatment for Depression and Anxiety. Now, here is the interview. Dr. David Burns, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me, David. I'm really psyched to be back on your show and can't wait to see what fireworks we can come up with today.
Yeah, me too. And it's been 12 years, can you believe that, since our last interview, which was on healing troubled relationships.
Oh, is that right? So we can go in a mood direction today or work on that one some more. But yes, 12 years, time just flies. It's frightening.
Yeah, really. So today we're going to be talking about your latest book, which is Feeling Great, The Revolutionary New Treatment for Depression and Anxiety. Now, you're a cognitive behavioral therapist in the mold of Albert Ellis and Aaron Beck, except I think you've gone way beyond them.
Thank you. Yeah, that's the idea. I loved learning from Ellis and Beck. When I was at Penn, I was doing psychopharmacology and research on the chemical imbalance theory about the brain, and I was pretty unhappy with the poor results I was seeing in my patients. I would give them pills and pills and pills, and they would talk and talk and talk, and nothing would ever seem to happen. And then when I heard about cognitive therapy that Aaron Beck, who recently just died, sadly, he lived to be over 100.
Wow.
But he had started it at Penn, and I thought it was really flaky, and decided to try it with some of my more severe patients just to satisfy myself that it wouldn't work. And then it did work with an awful lot of them.
Yeah.
So I was supposed to stay on the faculty. I had federal funding to develop a brain serotonin research laboratory at the medical school. And I just said, I don't want to do this. We've proven that the chemical imbalance theory is wrong. We published a paper in the top psychiatry journal in 1975 proving that this theory couldn't be correct. And it's only recently that people have finally accepted this, that the chemical imbalance theory was not valid. It's not the cause of depression. But I saw something that was working for my patients, and I said, this is what I want to spend my life doing. So I left the medical school. I stayed on the voluntary faculty and developed my clinical practice. And it's been a joyous ride. And initially I was thrilled with cognitive therapy, but then saw some areas where cognitive therapy and all forms of therapy were kind of failing. There were people who could be helped and others who weren't being helped. And I wanted to find out why. And the research and clinical experience that answered that question led to what I now call Team CBT, which in my hands is dramatically more effective than the original.
We're going to be getting into that.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say that the subtitle of your book, The Claims of New and Revolutionary, are pretty bold.
Yeah, that's right.
What is that based on? You had an earlier book called Feeling Good. So we've gone from feeling good to feeling great. What's the difference?
Well, there's four crucial changes from the original cognitive therapy and what we call team CBT that have led to dramatically faster recovery from depression and anxiety. That's the huge feature. I was always able to get pretty rapid recovery with many of my patients, but that meant like 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 sessions, which was considered almost impossible in that era of the 1970s and 80s and 90s. But then since we came back here to California, and since I've been at Stanford since about 1995, roughly, I've developed a weekly psychotherapy training group, which is free to community therapists. They can come to Stanford one day a week and get unlimited free psychotherapy training. And we've developed this new approach. And now the speed of recovery has changed so much. If someone had told me it was possible 15 years ago, I would have said they were a con artist. And what I mean is that 90% of my patients recover completely the first time I see them. Now, I always use a two-hour therapy session.
Okay.
I couldn't do it in a one-hour therapy session, but if I can have a two-hour therapy session, most people will become completely symptom-free from depression or anxiety, even if they've been depressed for decades and have had decades of failed therapy.
Wow. And that, do you measure that somehow?
Yeah, we measure it at the start and end of every single session. That's one of the features that made it possible. I've developed these short scales that are roughly 90 to 95% accurate on how are you feeling right now at this moment. So I find out how depressed they are exactly at the start of the session, how suicidal they are, how anxious they are, how angry they are, how happy. We measure that too. And they can complete these scales in about 1 minute. They do it before the session begins, so it doesn't waste any therapy time. And then I can see exactly what I'm dealing with. And then at the end of the session, I measure the exact same scales again. How are you feeling right now? And that's like having an emotional X-ray machine, so that shrinks, if they're courageous enough to do it, many are not, but right. If you're courageous enough to do it, it's like having this X-ray machine that where you can see inside the mind for the first time and find out for the first time how effective or ineffective you were in every single therapy session. And that's what led to the breakthroughs, because I began to have sessions where sometimes I thought they were sucky sessions, and yet the data showed it was an amazing session from the patient's point of view. So I was able to say, well, what did I do that was so mind-blowingly effective? And can I do that in other sessions with other patients? And then when I had sucky sessions, which still happens from time to time, then I find out exactly how I screwed up, the patients tell me. And then I stop doing that and start doing something else. And so that measuring, that accountability has been one of the things that's led to the breakthroughs in psychotherapy. And it's particularly important because I did research at the Stanford Hospital to find out how accurate are mental health professionals at estimating how their patients feel, because most therapists don't measure. They think they're very insensitive. They think they know what's going on. And I did an experiment to find out how accurate are they after a 2-hour interview with the patient at knowing how depressed the patient is, how suicidal the patient is, how angry the patient is, things like that. And also see if they could guess how the patient rated them, the interviewer, for empathy and compassion and helpfulness. And surprisingly, all of these measures were less than 10% accurate. in fact, let's say depression, that these experts were only 3% accurate in tracking how much depression had changed during the session. They were 0% accurate in knowing how suicidal the patient was. They were 0% accurate in knowing how angry the patient was.
Yeah. Wow.
And so once you get that data for the first time, you can start to see exactly how your patient feels and exactly how effective you are. And if you're humble, then
and
you
courageous.
Can let your, yeah, and courageous, yeah. Yeah. Then you can let your patients teach you a tremendous amount.
Yeah, someone else I've spoken with is Scott Miller.
Oh, yeah, he's into it, too. In fact, when he was a student, they had him using some of the earlier scales I had developed.
Really?
And so he was trained in this whole concept from the very get-go, and now he's really gone to town with it, too.
I was impressed that he found that there were a lot of reports that on average therapy was, about as good or slightly better than taking the pills.
But the placebo,
yeah.
Yeah.
And what he found was the problem was that they were lumping together good therapists and bad therapists.
Yeah.
And that if you single
exactly.
out the good therapists, the results were a lot better. And so he also now really advocates questionnaires after every session.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, I did a recent study at the Feeling Good Institute. I had data, the start and end of session data on over 11,000 therapy sessions from large numbers of patients and large numbers of therapists. And one of the amazing things I discovered is the amount of improvement the first time you meet with your therapist is an actual measure of that therapist's therapeutic skill and will predict the entire course of therapy.
I can believe it. We should. You call your approach TEAM, CBT.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's an acronym. Give us what TEAM stands
well,
for.
Well, T is the thing we covered already. That's the testing at the beginning and end of every session.
Okay.
E is empathy. And the idea here is before you do anything to help your patient, you've got to let the patient cry and vent and show warmth and support. And we measure empathy within the session and after the session is over with extremely sensitive scales that will highlight the tiniest failure on the therapist's part. And so we won't do anything to try to help a patient until we're getting perfect A or A-plus empathy scores from the patient. And we have rigorous training to give therapists the skills they need to really see the world through the patient's eyes and to make the patient feel cared about and respected and liked and that type of thing. Now, empathy itself doesn't have much healing punch to it.
Yeah. Let me go back to the team we were doing.
Okay,
so
sure.
So the A is assessment, which you were just talking about, right?
No. It's the assessment of resistance. The T is the testing before and after. The E, then the E is the empathy, and then comes the assessment of resistance. And that's the most unique feature to TEAM, and why it works so fast is because I've figured out new methods to bring subconscious resistance to change, to conscious awareness and melt it away at the pass.
Yeah. Well, by bringing in resistance and what was the other one? And secondary gains, what traditionally was called secondary gains.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
is, what is the person, what are the benefits to the person of the symptoms that they're presenting?
Yeah.
And that narrows the gap. So much narrows the gap between the world of depth psychotherapy, cognitive psychotherapy, CBT, as it was originally conceived. And I just heard you use the word unconscious. And, of course, to the originators behaviorism, unconscious would have been a bad, bad word.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And I think Freud was right in a sense and wrong in a sense. he was right that resistance is a real thing. And so what that means is, let's say someone's very perfectionistic and self-critical. That's the, one of the big keys to depression. I'm not good enough, and I shouldn't have screwed up, and I'm a loser, and what's wrong with me, and I'm not smart enough, and all of that. Those are the, some of the thoughts that cause depression. And what we've discovered is that resistance is real, but Freud thought it was, and the world has thought it's because of what's wrong with the patient. Like, you resist because you want secondary gain. You want people to feel sorry for you. And that makes it look like resistance is some kind of a personality defect, or you're a whiner, you know. And what we've found is the resistance actually results from what's most beautiful and awesome about the patient and the patient's core values. For example, if someone's very perfectionistic and beating up on themselves all the time, those self-critical thoughts are the actual cause of the depression. But the patient will often fight against the therapist who tries to talk him out of those thoughts, because the thoughts are an expression of the patient's core values. For example, the self-critical thought shows that you have high standards.
Okay.
And those high standards motivate you to work hard and to produce some your best work. And your self-criticalness shows your humility, which is a spiritual quality. And your self-criticism shows that you're honest about your flaws and willing to admit them.
So, and you've reframed them in the session too.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yes. Like you begin to see all of your symptoms and your resistance as really beautiful and awesome things. And so paradoxically, we're trying to talk the patient into not changing.
Yeah.
Look at all the beautiful things that your shame shows about you. Look at the tremendous things that your anger shows about you. Your anger is probably very justified. People can be pretty mean-spirited. Your anxiety keeps you safe, protects you from failure, keeps you vigilant. Your sadness and despair is probably very, very valid. You may have some things that really are worth being sad about. And the odd thing is that once the patient begins to see their symptoms as beautiful things, not defects, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association says you have mental disorders. Do you see that's why you're depressed and anxious?
Yeah.
And I say, phooey to that. There's only three mental disorders: schizophrenia, bipolar 1, and Alzheimer's disease. Those are organic brain disorders. But all the rest of it is not the result of what's wrong with you, but what's right with you. And the odd thing is, the moment the patient sees this, depression is just a stone's throw away. Then it's easy for them to blow away these distorted thoughts at the M equals methods, TEAM. See, once we get rid of the resistance, then the methods work really quickly. And that's the revolutionary thing. Freud tried to get rid of resistance by having them free associate on the couch 5 days a week for 5 years. And it really wasn't terribly effective. I've never met anyone who was helped by it. Probably there are some, but but now we can do that job that Freud was trying to do in about 25 to 30 minutes with each patient the first time I sit down with them. So it takes the empathy takes a half an hour, the A of assessment of resistance takes a half an hour, and then it generally takes maybe 15 to 20 minutes, 30 minutes to blow their negative thoughts out of the water using a variety of techniques, and then they're typically symptom-free, if not euphoric. And then we do relapse prevention training, which takes 20 to 25 minutes. And then generally we're done at that point. And then I tell my patients, if you ever have a relapse, you will relapse. We all relapse all the time. We get upset. That's the human condition. But if you have a relapse you can't handle, I'll give you unlimited free upgrades tune-ups for the rest of your life.
Wow.
And I hope you will relapse, because if you don't, I'll never see you again. I just got to know you now and got to really liking you, and you went and recovered on me. So try to relapse. But then I generally never see them again.
Yeah,
occasionally they come back.
So I'm always looking for the parallels with other approaches or the commonalities, you know, that have been around in psychotherapy. And much of what when you talked about the paradoxical response and approach, that's short-term psychotherapy, which started around Stanford and the VA system down there. That was a big part of that, you know.
And also the guy in Scottsdale.
Yes.
Erickson.
Milton Erickson, exactly.
Yeah.
He was on my mind, too.
He was into paradox and then into resistance. I think that's definitely huge. And in the early days of cognitive therapy, we deny that. And almost all cognitive therapists and almost all therapists of almost all schools of therapy still have no idea how to deal with resistance, and they try to treat people without it. And that's why in all outcome studies to date, half of patients are not helped. Half of patients are helped, and they're the ones who buy into what the therapist is selling. But half of them are resisting, and that's why. And the best that any outcome studies have ever produced is a 54% reduction in symptoms in months of therapy.
Yeah.
That's poor, because what they call a reduction in symptoms is just a 50% reduction in depression. So half the patients don't even get a 50% reduction, and the half who are improved, most of them are just getting a partial improvement. I'm looking for 100% improvement in one session the first time I sit down with somebody.
Well, it's striking to me, too, is that CBT was one of the ones that fit what the American Psychological Association was shooting for, manualized approaches, suggests, you know, if you could spell it all out in a nice manual, and if people followed the manual, they would get good results. And so match that against the fact that you're taking people who are therapists, who are already trained to be therapists, and you're working with them in a workshop, and they need to be retrained.
Yeah.
So, So.
And it's hard. It's hard to retrain them, because a lot of them, they're almost like cult members. And they believe what they've been trained in. They believe what their guru taught them. And I'm trying to move, as well as the gentleman you mentioned earlier in the interview, to do data-driven therapy, not cult-driven therapy, and let the numbers guide us. But I have probably over 50,000 therapists in the United States and Canada have come to my training programs over the last 30 years or so.
Wow.
And I make things look easy when I demonstrate them, and I do live demonstrations in workshops so they can see me working with some volunteer from the audience in real time. But it's hard for therapists to learn these techniques, and for that reason, I've developed an app, because I think I can develop an electronic version of myself that's more effective than me and that will outperform human therapists. And so
I doubt it.
A number of young people have approached me, and we've formed a little company. We don't have any funding yet. We're just kind of doing it ourselves. And we're right now in the midst of a pretty big beta test with beta testers, and it looks like that has been realized. In one day, people using this Feeling Good app are improving an average of 70% in depression, and also a 70% boost in happiness, a 70% reduction to 80% in anger, in hopelessness, in loneliness. We're measuring six different negative feelings very accurately, plus happiness. And the neat thing about it is now that we've reached that kind of like hydrogen fusion, it's producing more than it's demanding. And now we'll be able to modify it and improve it to get it even better and better. You see, human therapists, it's hard for them to modify and get better and better because they don't measure. They're rigidly attached to things that don't really work. But the app, see, I always knew a computer would do what I wanted it to do. It wouldn't fight me. But I think that a human therapist can provide something that an app could never provide. But our app can produce things now already that human therapists will never be able to compete with. And so the combination of those two could be the therapy of the future, where we do all the really hard stuff for the therapist, and they can do the warmth, the compassion, the empathy, the in-person support that some really severe people need. But we can transform, I think, with our app, the future of therapy. So we're going to be raising some funding, try to raise funding starting in January, because we need to get some money to pay all these people who are helping us mainly on a volunteer basis right now. But I'm very excited.
There are apps out there now, of course, that are this is kind of, you're entering a
crowded field.
I don't know. Is it crowded already?
I think there's thousands of these things. Everyone thinks they can make an app, but if you look at the data on them, they really suck. Most of them don't even do like a placebo. They're clunky and superficial. That's why I wanted to develop something really good. But it's like the original automobile. There were 1,000 automobile companies at the time Ford was starting his company, and they almost all dropped by the wayside. But some of these things are, you know, they're very commercial. They're heavily funded, but they're, as the Buddha so often said, dorky at best. I shouldn't say that, but that's the way I see it.
Interesting that you quote the Buddha.
Yeah.
Let's see. You know, you mentioned the final letter M in team is methods. And and you've created more than 100, I guess you'd call them interventions, strategies. Things that a person could say at the appropriate time. And so, you know, so that's a big part of your intervention and of the magic sauce of your approach.
Yeah, right. And I used to think that was the whole thing. You know, that's why I created so many methods, because if I was stuck with someone, I'd create new methods until we found a breakthrough. I would say the real sauce is the assessment of resistance. That's the magic fluid that leads to high-speed recovery. But the methods are fantastic, too. And like the externalization of voices, one of the techniques I developed, a lot of Beck's early techniques were dry and boring. I shouldn't say that, but it's the truth. They were. They weren't dynamic. Like, examine the evidence. When you tell yourself you're a loser, well, what's the evidence that you're a loser? What's the evidence that you're not a loser? And stuff like that, kind of logical things, but they didn't have a lot of emotional oomph. And I wanted emotionally powerful thoughts, techniques that could like kind of blow patients' minds within minutes, get people to enlightenment within minutes, not within decades of meditation or something like that. And like in the early days of cognitive therapy, the way I stumbled across this powerful technique, externalization of voices, I was working at home and I thought, well, I'm criticizing myself and I have to see if these techniques work, because I don't want to throw my life into something that's a fraud. So I wrote down my negative thoughts. I think Beck had criticized me or something about something. And I said, I'm a loser. I'm, you know, kind of worthless. And I have no therapeutic skill. And it all seemed true to me. And then I identified the distortions and wrote positive, realistic thoughts to challenge and crush my negative thoughts. And I thought I did a really good job and I was feeling better. And then I handed the sheet to my wife and I said, Melanie, I just want to make sure I can crush these negative thoughts I've been having. Verbalize them to me like you're some other person. You can be the negative David and say those things to me. Say, David, you're worthless. you have no future as a therapist, you have no skill, you're a horrible human being. Just say things like that to me in the second person you. So she said, okay, I want you to know that you're really a failure as a therapist because Dr. Beck criticized you. And then all of a sudden, I couldn't talk back to it. And I said, well, hit me with another one. And she said, well, you're basically a worthless human being. And all of a sudden, I felt like a bug pinned to a wall. And I could not defeat these things. And I said, hey, give me a couple more days to work on these. You're killing me right now. Then I worked on them for 2 days. And then I said, now let's try again. And then she hit me with these thoughts, and I absolutely blew her out of the water. I came back with positive, realistic thoughts that totally crushed those thoughts, and I felt fantastic. I said, man, this is a killer technique. And then I began using it in my clinical practice and in my training of therapists, too. And I just won over 100 techniques that I use for helping patients crush their negative thoughts. But I use a lot of dramatic techniques that involve role-playing that are much more activating than the traditional cognitive therapy techniques. And they still have value. Examine the evidence has been life-changing for some number of patients that I've seen.
Yeah.
But the new techniques that we use are just way more powerful, I would say.
Give me a feeling for the role. Again, I'm thinking, well, lots of therapists have used role playing. Imagine that I'm your father, or put your father on the chair and talk to your father.
Oh, yeah. Gestalt type of things.
Right. Yeah. So are you talking about something that's different from that?
Well, when I create things, they have my own unique flair, so they won't be similar to anything that you've seen. But I would say that these techniques are in that Gestalt tradition, absolutely, or the psychodramatic tradition. I used to see this type of thing in psychodramas when I was a medical student. I hated medical school and never should have gone. I should have done psychology. But someone said to me, oh, you should be a psychiatrist. So I cut most of my classes, and I used to go to this place called the Human Institute in Palo Alto that was headed up by this fellow, Hussein Chung. And he was just a lay individual, but he would put on like these 48-hour marathons.
Uh-huh.
And you'd get challenged heavily and brought to tears and have these kind of transformational experiences.
Encounter groups, essentially.
Yeah, you know, more than they were in the encounter tradition, but they were more intense. Encounter group was kind of like the light version, and this is like the heavy version.
Okay.
and they were terrifying, but traumatic. And I saw people changed dramatically in a matter of minutes. I saw it was possible. But the problem with it is it was all lay people running these things. And every now and then someone ended up in the Stanford Hospital after one of these marathons.
Mm.
And they were occasionally could have a terrifying and brutal effect on people. And so I thought, how could we do that in a super safe way, like that would have no downside to it? So that's how I developed the externalization of voices. And then if the patient can't crush the thought, you do an immediate role reversal. And so you modify, show them how to
crush it for them. Yeah.
And so you can bring people to enlightenment that way, doing frequent role reversals in just a matter of minutes in most cases. And I developed a daily cognitive therapy group for the Stanford inpatient unit, the psychiatric unit, because it was all psychopharmacology. And I used to use these techniques with the most severe patients there at Stanford, patients who were suicidal or severe anorexia nervosa or extreme anxiety disorders. And found that they were helpful not only for outpatients but for the severe inpatient population as well. But they require skill, they require compassion, and because they're so powerful, they have the potential to hurt the patient as well as to transform the patient's life if they're not done with tremendous compassion and skill.
Hmm. So how much training do you find that therapists need to correct course and get on track?
I've had high-powered therapists who have IQs easily over 150 and more, of people who would be considered geniuses and whose graduate school records and college records, you know, at Harvard. And I've seen people like that take 7 years to get to the beginner's level. The techniques look very simple, but they're so anti-intuitive that they're difficult for therapists to learn. Some people have an aptitude for them, and they teach with me in my weekly training group, and they have become, I'm sure, among the world's top therapists, because like myself, they see recovery in just 2-3 sessions with most of the people who come to them. Mm. But they're not common. And that's why I'm developing this app, because I think, you know, my idea with the app is, you know, send your patients to me, I'll cure them for you, and you can take the credit type of thing. Yeah. And you can do the individual part and the warmth, the human part, but there's just no way that most therapists can be able to learn all of these techniques, but the computer can learn them. And can do them. And so that's it. If anyone is interested, by the way, we're doing all these free beta tests. My website is almost everything is free. I haven't charged anyone for therapy in 25 years. I do all volunteer teaching at Stanford. And my website is all kinds of things for free. And if you want to, my weekly podcast, we just had our 4 millionth download. And also the Feeling Good app, if you go to feelinggood.com/app, then you can sign up there to be a beta tester if you're curious about it.
I'm impressed in this latest book, Feeling Great. In the appendix, you've got a list of resources. They're all free resources. And I'm, you know, really impressed by your generosity in that
Thank
regard.
You.
And was going to so give us the URLs that are really important for people to go to.
Sure.
Thank you for that,
David. I really appreciate it. It's just feelinggood.com. Feeling good is one word with two G's in the middle. www.feelinggood.com, and then you can click on the podcast tab and you'll find all of my podcasts. We're up to about 260 now with links, titles and links. So if something, and there's a search function there. So if you want to find out if you've got OCD or, you know, you can listen to the podcast, a 3-minute OCD cure. You'll talk to a woman who had Howard Hughes's disease for 20 years. And I treated her in one of the Tuesday groups at Stanford. And we actually had a video showing the actual moment of her recovery there that evening. Or if you have depression or relationship problems, it'll show you all the relevant podcasts to help you. You can go to feelinggood.com/app and sign up to be a beta tester. There's all kinds of stuff there. There's not only the tons of podcasts, there's blogs and tools, but the books too. If you want to shell out a little money, Feeling Great, the new book, is being sold ridiculously cheap on Amazon right now. It's almost the price of a paperback. I think it was originally $26 and they're selling it like for $16 or something like that. Or you can buy my original Feeling Good book used on Amazon for just a couple of dollars. And weirdly, the ones they're sending, the fellow told me he's getting hard copy first editions of Feeling Good, which are quite rare and worth a lot of money. And I don't know where they found a few of them. But you can get Feeling Good, the new mood therapy, which 60% of the people who read it recover from depression in 4 weeks without any treatment. or the book when panic attacks, if you have, you know, anxiety disorders, that's the book I wrote on all the techniques for treating anxiety. Or if you have relationship problems, you can get feeling good together. If you go to my book page, you'll see a lot of the books I've written, but you have to pay for them. But most of them are mass market paperbacks, so they're like maybe $8 or $10. And if you get the book and do the written exercises, you'll get tremendous dividends. But yes, I do most things for free, and I'm glad I can do that because it just makes everything so much better. Because when you're training people for free, they know your goal is to help them learn. And when you're treating people for free, they can't accuse you of having, you know, money, because yeah. The only reward I get is seeing them cured. And I don't care if I cure them in one patient, one session, because I'm not trying to get them to come back endlessly to stabilize my income. But yeah. When I see somebody recover, we had a woman that I treated again in one of my Tuesday groups, and she had been raised in a village in Mexico, and she was short and overweight, and she had 8 brothers and sisters, and her skin was the darkest of all, and she had a learning disability. So she said she was belittled and made fun of and really brutalized all growing up. And she came to see herself as an outsider and someone who wasn't good enough, and has spent her life feeling inadequate. And she's been coming. She now lives in the United States. And she was driving over 2 hours every Tuesday to come each way from the Central Valley to come to our Tuesday group so she could learn. And then 2 hours home at the end of the evening, and tremendously motivated, but she hardly said a word for four years in the group. And then she finally opened up and asked if I would do a personal work with her in the group. And she said she realized that she has always felt like she's not good enough. She's felt depressed and inferior and self-critical. And we worked with her, and it just blew her mind. She went from severe depression to zero depression and into euphoria. And that's what I try to get for my patients, not just less depressed, but an elimination of your depression and into joy, enlightenment. And she just wrote that she's been dancing in stores now. She was cripplingly shy. She danced, and some woman came up to her and said, "You go, girl," because, you know, there's this music in grocery stores or department stores, and yeah. She's just so happy. And her life has been transformed. And that's what I went into the field for. And it's the greatest thing, because when my patients feel that way, then I feel that way.
Of course.
And that's my reward. And it's the greatest reward.
Well, what about the pandemic that we're in? I mean, if you look at it externally, there are a lot of good reasons to be depressed and to feel like like we're in a hopeless situation.
Sure.
How do you combat that in yourself?
Well, I mean, that's the most basic thing of all. It goes back 2,000 years to the teachings of the Greek philosopher Epictetus, is that we're not disturbed by events, by things, but by our views about them. And while the pandemic is genuinely a negative thing, if somebody's feeling excessive anxiety or depression or anger or whatever, that's still due to your thoughts. And the thoughts that cause those negative feelings are 100% of the time going to be distorted and illogical. And the moment you crush those thoughts and stop believing them using a variety of techniques, your negative feelings will change. And to prove this, on my Feeling Good podcasts, I've had a subsection of coronacasts, where I've taken people who have had severe depressions, which they thought were caused by the pandemic, mm-hmm. and worked with them, again, saying a total elimination of symptoms in a single session. And it's really what you're telling yourself. And I just recorded a little section on the app about this to demonstrate it. And this was not a pandemic thing, but something similar or worse. It was a woman I saw early in my career, and I was asked to see her at the Stanford Hospital because she was just diagnosed with terminal ovarian cancer and was depressed. And someone said, would you be willing to see her at the bedside in the hospital? Because she's a beloved member of our department, or the administration, and we can't stand to see her so depressed. So I went and I worked with her and asked her, you know, she was a, you know, delightful person, but she was devastated. She was in her 40s and she suddenly discovered that she had 2 years to live and her ovarian cancer was untreatable. And obviously, you know, it's to be sad about something like that is totally understandable. But I asked her, well, would you want my help today if I could help you right now? And she said, oh, I definitely would. And I said, well, what are you telling yourself? What are your thoughts? And she said, well, I have three thoughts. I'm letting my family down. They can't survive without me. And it's my fault. I got cancer. I said, what do you mean by those thoughts? How much do you believe those thoughts? She says, oh, I believe them 100%. And turned out she was caring for a lot of relatives of hers to let them come and live in her house. They had disabilities, and that's what she meant. What they can't live without me. I'm letting them down. And then I said to her, I just used a simple one of the early role play techniques. I said, imagine there's a woman in the bed right next to you. She was in a single room at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. But I said, imagine you're in a double room, and there's a woman here just like you. Amy, I'll call her Amy, and she's in her 40s and she has terminal ovarian cancer. And tell her now you're letting your family down. Just say that out loud to her. And she looked puzzled. She says, "Doctor, I can't say that to someone." And I said, "Well, why not, Amy?" She said, well, I'm a deeply religious woman, and I don't believe in being cruel to people and hurting people, and that would be cruel. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, right, you are about that, but you're a people. You're saying that to yourself. So you seem to have a double standard going on here. But I said, since you're a religious woman, we know it says somewhere in the Bible, the truth shall set you free. And since you believe these things 100%, you must say them to this lady. Tell her the truth. Tell her that it's her fault she got cancer and she's letting her family down. And she said, I still can't say those things. I said, why not, Amy? And I said, she said, because it's malarkey. I said, you're right. These thoughts are not valid. And that's the cause of your depression. What would you say to this woman? I said, your family loves you and they appreciate what you're doing for them. And they'll be sad when you die, but it's ridiculous to think that they feel like you're letting them down. And furthermore, you know as well as I do that they've got good resources, they've got good coping skills, and they'll survive and prosper after you die. They'll miss you, but they will survive. And then the idea that it's your fault you have cancer, you got ovarian cancer, this is the greatest rubbish I've ever heard. Scientists don't know the cause of ovarian cancer. You couldn't give yourself cancer if you tried. I said, how much do you believe that? And she said, 100%. I said, how much do you believe your negative thoughts now? She said, 0%. And I said, how are you feeling? She says, my depression just vanished.
Wow.
And it was such a beautiful thing. It took 45 minutes. And I never saw her again as a patient after that day. I saw her a lot, you know, ran into her. We were in the same orbit in the medical school. But she was always feeling happy. She felt loved. She felt cherished. She felt productive. Sadly, she died right on schedule 2 years later. But I was just so glad that she didn't have to waste the last precious 2 years of her life in misery and depression. And it's the same with the pandemic. The pandemic is genuinely negative. It's real. Fear is indicated. I'm afraid. But if you go from fear to an anxiety disorder, or you go from sadness into depression and hopelessness, that's where you might need a little tune-up. In a book like my new one, Feeling Great, or my original one, Feeling Good, or the Feeling Good podcast could be very, very helpful to you. But yes, there has been a doubling of depression rates, anger rates, and anxiety rates because of this pandemic.
Great story. Great story. Is there anything more that we should touch on, I think, before we roll this up?
No, it's just a great pleasure for me to talk with you and hang out. I hope it's not another 12 years before we we talk again. You know, I just turned 79, and we don't live forever, but this is the greatest joy period of my life, and I feel like I'm the most creative and productive. I feel like I'm about 16 years old.
Wow.
And I'm just filled with energy, but I had a cardiac issue in the summer and was hospitalized at Kaiser for several days, and so I was aware of how fragile life really is. And I just try to turn every day into something really, really fantastic, and I just feel blessed. I mean, how lucky is it that I can hang out with you today, and that I've got young colleagues to be working with on stuff, and I'm just very grateful. I hope I can just keep kicking along, because I have most of my work still ahead of me.
Yeah.
But yes, thank you for listening, people.
Well, I want to thank you for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio. And I do hope that we'll have more contact, and we can make that happen.
Great.
How lucky I am to have the opportunities to speak with David Burns, MD. I'm so impressed by his industriousness, clarity of mind, and generosity. As any longtime listeners will know, I've been aligned with humanistic psychology and depth psychotherapies. So on the face of it, I should be in a very different camp than Dr. Burns, yet I find myself in complete alignment with most everything he says. I remember having the same reaction when I interviewed him a dozen years ago. He causes me cognitive dissonance, and I'm pretty sure he'd be glad to hear that. He violates just about all my stereotypical expectations of a CBT practitioner. He acknowledges Albert Ellis as one of his forebears, but he's so different in his personality and his theoretical stance. What the two have in common is the conviction that the erroneous things we tell ourselves can lead to emotional distress. I had the opportunity to see Ellis in action. His approach to making patients aware of their thinking distortions and irrational assumptions was to browbeat them into submission. Empathy was nowhere to be seen. However, Ellis wrote quite a few self-help books that were bestsellers in their time, and many readers found them helpful. So that's something that Dr. Burns has in common with Dr. Ellis. But to my mind, Dr. Burns is in a very different league by virtue of his humility, empathy, self-disclosure, commitment to truth, willingness to confront his own errors, and engagement with scientific research. I found myself looking for Dr. Burns' secret sauce. It's really spelled out in the TEAM acronym he uses to describe the essentials of his approach. The letter T refers to testing before and after each session, in which the client uses a rating scale to express how they were feeling at the beginning of the session and at the end. This is tremendous feedback for the therapist, who has the courage to hear the client's candid perceptions and to make adjustments accordingly. This is still a relatively new innovation in our field. I mentioned Dr. Scott Miller as a strong advocate for this approach, and it's also evolved to a practice known as deliberate practice. Dr. Burns' research has shown that both therapists and outside observer ratings of therapist/client interactions tend to differ from the client's ratings. Hopefully, the training of future therapists will incorporate this sort of feedback. It's painful at first, but trained therapists can improve. The use of audio recordings and later video recordings at first met with resistance, but have become standard supervision tools. However, we can go further with client feedback before and after each session. The letter E in team represents empathy. Both research and experience have taught us the importance of empathy, especially in the beginning when the therapist is building an alliance with the client. The letter A refers to assessing the client's resistance to change and the secondary gains their depression or anxiety is affording them. This bit of secret sauce puts Burns's approach in sync with the insights of all those who practice the varieties of depth psychotherapy. Of course, the difference for Dr. Burns is that his use of these insights can radically reduce the length of treatment, even to as few as a single session. The letter M in team refers to methods, that is, what specific intervention is going to free the client from the symptoms they've been suffering from. As we heard in the interview, the ingenious Dr. David Burns has come up with 100 or more specific interventions. He's not hoarding this magic. You'll find them in his books. And he's not satisfied with mere symptom relief. No, he's shooting for joy, something more like enlightenment. It should be clear from everything I've said here that I'm extremely impressed by Dr. David Burns. His generosity is on display in the two books we mentioned, Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, and Feeling Great, The Revolutionary New Treatment for Depression and Anxiety, as well as his podcasts and other tools and resources you'll find on his website, www.feelinggood.com.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Russell from New South Wales, Australia. You asked me to put together just a quick note to say why I was happy to support Shrink Wrap Radio. I discovered these podcasts totally by accident a few months ago and been systematically working my way through them. I was looking for ways to increase my educational experience and content whilst travelling to and from work and stumbled upon your podcast, yeah, quite by chance. I've been blown away by the breadth and sophistication and the richness of the educational resource that you've got going there, Dave, and really is a tribute to your hard work and dedication. I think, like someone else may have said in the past on one of your previous podcasts, for me, the thought of you not doing this work through financial constraints was, a big motivator for me to put my hand in my pocket. So keep up the good work, Dave. It's brilliant.
Thank you, Russell Davies in New South Wales, Australia, for your endorsement. You've made my day. I feel seen and valued and encouraged to keep on keeping on. Once again, as I review the honor roll in putting together today's podcast, I'm so appreciative of all you monthly donors. In fact, I'd like to read out the names of you monthly donors whose donations have landed in the last few days. And they are Thomas V. Cliff, Robert Canora, and Connections Counseling. And of course, thank you to all you other monthly supporters. Time to shrink wrap it up. Thanks again to my return guest, psychiatrist and author David Burns, MD, discussing his very inspiring work and his book, Feeling Great, The Revolutionary New Treatment for Depression and Anxiety. Next week, my guest will be unconventional UK therapist and author Jerry Hyde, discussing his work and his remarkable book, Empathy for the Devil, Make Your Demons Work for You Without Selling Your Soul. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.